Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, aside from the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum, what other museums and institutions have contributed to this exhibition? On December 1st, the world's first Auschwitz traveling exhibition opened at Arte Canal Exhibition Center in Madrid, its only venue in Spain. The exhibition, subtitled Not Long Ago, Not Far Away, was created and developed by the Spanish company Musealia and can be visited in Madrid until June 17th. It will then travel to other world cities. The content of the exhibition was developed by a team from the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum, together with a multidisciplinary group of international experts on Holocaust history and education, which Musealia brought together to create the largest traveling exhibition ever devoted to Auschwitz. Before arriving at the parts of the exhibition that are devoted to Auschwitz itself, visitors can see sections on what it means to be Jewish and historical events leading up to the Holocaust. Luis Ferreiro, director of Musealia, spoke with us about the exhibition. Thank you very much for speaking with us today, Luis. Could you first tell us how the idea for this traveling exhibition came about, whose idea it was, and the other organizations that collaborated, and who is or what is Musealia?
Thank you very much, Linda, for this interest in the exhibit. The idea of creating a traveling monographic exhibition about the exhibition came in 2009, and that was Musealia is a very small family company, and we do exhibitions, traveling exhibitions. So we had an exhibition that was traveling, and we were in Valencia, in the Museum of, in the City of Arts and Science. And it was basically my parents, my uncle, and my brother. And my brother suddenly died from a heart attack in 2008, when he was, I believe, 24, and I was 23, or he was 25, and I was 24. So that was, of course, devastating for the family, for the company. And at that time, I had a girlfriend whose mother was from L.A. They were living in Valencia. And she gave me 1 year later, for my birthday in April 2009, the book Man in Search of Meaning by Viktor Frankl, which in the beginning I have to say I was not sure to read, because I felt it was a little bit, maybe I didn't know anything about the book or about him. I thought it was a little bit like self-helping or things like that, and I was a little bit like reluctant to read it. But that summer I was just staring at the book, and I decided to just read the few first pages. And that edition, she gave it to me in English. So that edition started with a small foreword by him, where he explains this Viktor Frankl. He was born in Vienna, and he was living in Vienna. He was a psychiatrist, and he had the chance to actually take a visa and go to the States with his wife. She was pregnant, but he had to leave his parents behind in Vienna. They could not go with him to the States, and of course he didn't know what to do, because he knew that his parents would face a terrible fate if they were left behind in Vienna. So he doesn't know what to do. And then his father went to a synagogue that had been destroyed, and he managed to get a one piece. I don't know if it was a piece of a Torah or a brick where there was an inscription. And he asked which inscription was that, and it was about honoring the parents. So that's the moment he decides to stay in Vienna, whatever happened. So he decides to leave his visa and stays in Vienna. And of course, he's then, being a Jew, he's sent to the concentration camps. being one of them Auschwitz. His parents die, his wife, pregnant wife, dies, and he writes this book about the experience, psychological experience of being in a concentration camp. And I was really touched by it. I was moved by it. I was, you know this feeling with when somebody moves something inside of you, and then you have this sense when you need to share this experience with your friends, with your family, with. And it happens that, of course, if I would have been a writer, I would probably have tried to write a book. Or if I was a filmmaker, I would have tried to make a film. It happened that what we did, what we do in Musealia, is exhibitions. So the way I could contribute to the memory of all of what happened and was to try to have to create an exhibition about Auschwitz and its historical context.
Well, I'm very impressed that such a small enterprise could put together such an amazingly big and complete exhibition.
I mean, I honestly, that was of course 2009. Now we are in 2018, so it has been a long, very long journey, and many things have happened. But I think we managed to do it because we didn't know how difficult it is. It is the first time when we were in the opening, I don't know if you were in the opening, but the people from the museum, they told us, you know, we made history. I mean, this is the first time in history that a large collection of original artifacts go outside of Poland. Most of them have never been displayed before in a traveling monographic exhibition about Auschwitz. And many people that we have met along the journey, they just ask, how come nobody did this before? And I guess nobody did it because it has been really, really complex to manage to be able to have this agreement with the museum, this co-production, all this amazing team of historians and curators, Robert Jan Van Pel, Michael Birnbaum, world experts, Paul Salmons, Miriam Greenbaum, Jamel Zanetti, an amazing team, and a very small team, actually. Because this is it's like a family in Musealia, so we're not a big organization. We don't have limitless resources. We are a very small company, and all these people came together, and all these institutions, starting from the Auschwitz Museum, came together because they believed, actually, that something good could come out of this. So it's been amazing.
How did you happen to come to Madrid first?
Well, we are a Spanish company, and I don't know, but I guess people that listen to us when... It happens to me, I don't know if to many people, but when I go and I see a movie that I like very much, or I read a book that I like very much, you know, immediately you just go to your friends and your family and tell them, oh, you really have to see this movie, you really have to read this book, I mean, please do it. So whenever you create an exhibition, you do want to share it with your society. You know, we are Spaniards and we are from Spain, and also we felt that we don't have an Holocaust museum in Spain, and I think that we lack that knowledge and that memory in Spain. So it was also, it made a lot of sense also, and of course it is easier when you start in your own country, logistically speaking, than when you do it in Berlin or in New York. But the basic issue was that we thought this story should be told in our country.
Where else will the exhibit go after this? I know you're going to a number of cities in Europe and in other places. Where else will it be going?
Well, the idea, the plan is actually to be in 6 more cities in Europe and 7 more cities between North America, Australia, and Asia. So right now we are starting to close this list of cities. I think the museum will make an announcement in the next weeks about the second city. And of course, everybody wanted to see the exhibit first. So I think that, which makes a lot of sense, of course. And I think in the next months it will be, there's a lot of museums and a lot of cities coming to Madrid to see the exhibition. And I hope that that makes easier to close this list of cities. One of the initial subtitles of the exhibition was The World of Auschwitz, Auschwitz in the World. So it's this notion of the whole of Europe, not the whole of Europe, but many parts of Europe were sent into this dot on the map. And then with the liberation, all of these stories of the 7,000 that survived began to go to the world. So it felt like it was also this sense of putting again together all these stories that were scattered through the world.
Have you had any visits from school groups, and what ages are they, and what kind of reactions have you gotten from them?
Well, schools, because we actually believe strongly that this is an educational tool and the exhibition, and it's through a process of education that hopefully we can prevent hatred and new episodes, tragic episodes happening again. Schools come for free, so we have many of them. I think there's already like 20,000 kids that will come through schools to the exhibition, and we are opening more slots for them to come. And the reaction, what I am amazed and surprised, even with schools, which is not easy, is that first of all, the schools tend to spend a little bit less than a regular visitor because they have to, you know, they have a bus waiting for them, and they have a schedule to follow. So it's usually around 2 hours for them, and I am amazed and surprised by the silence and by the respect that even young people, which is not always easy, show, you know, to the memory of victims when they walk through the exhibition, their interest and their respect. And that gives us hope in the future.
How old are most of these kids?
Of course, as you may know, the museum recommends the visit to the site actually from 12 or 13 and above. We kind of follow the same policy in that sense. Of course, you may find on a Saturday or a Sunday a family with children from 6 or 7 or 8. And it's actually something very interesting because we don't ban anybody from coming to the exhibition. If we are asked, we would say we would recommend for 13 and above, but it's up to each parent to decide. Okay. So the average, I think, it's around 15 to 16, 17. That would be the average. Of course, we don't have children from, you know, very young ages. But I do see young children from 8 or 9 or even or 10 coming with their parents. And some actually, you know, follow the whole story of the exhibition. So I'm also surprised by that.
Have you gotten any feedback specifically from the school groups?
I know that we are sending them questions about the visit. I have not actually had time to look into their answers yet. But by the amount of bookings that we have from schools and what we see in social media after the visit and the school post, everybody is, they understand that it's a tough visit, that it's no fun to come here, but it's necessary to come. So that's what the feedback that we are getting so far.
Do you provide any preparatory materials, or is that something that the schools have to do themselves?
We want to prepare one. Unfortunately, we don't have it right now. It's something that we are finishing because we have to work with the museum and with Paul. In this case, the educational material is with Paul Salmons, which is an expert in this. And so we do send them the script of the exhibition so that the teacher can actually look into it and probably make an emphasis on one or more subjects. And hopefully we will be able to provide more information, more pedagogical tools in the next weeks.
Do you have any profile of the visitors? Do you have any idea of who's coming, how much they might have known before? Because I know that in Spanish schools, even World War II is often dealt with in two paragraphs. And Spain wasn't involved in World War II, mm-hmm. really. They have two paragraphs about World War II and practically nothing about the Holocaust. And I know that the Centro Sefarad Israel is working a lot on Holocaust education. But do you have any idea of the profile of the visitors?
We do have certain statistics because most of the tickets are bought online. So that helps us to be able to ask a few questions and then send emails where we can ask different kind of questions like age and sex and reasons why they came to the exhibition. So we are starting to just, the exhibition opened 1 month ago, so we are just now starting to analyze. Our first impressions are that the average visitor would be between 25 and 40 in that area. And maybe, of course, in the first weeks, we do have a lot of people with interest in this subject, either the Holocaust or Auschwitz or even the Second World War as a broader theme. But I do feel that as the weeks go by, we will have more and more visitors without or hardly any previous knowledge about this matter. So, and that will be also interesting because I think a lot of people will come to the exhibit expecting to be faced with Auschwitz immediately, and I think it's going to be quite surprising for them to find out that actually we do have a very wide, long area, which is called Before Auschwitz, that deals with all the intellectual ingredients that made possible the extermination. And so we take visitors gradually in a journey. They don't have to face Auschwitz immediately. I don't think it would have worked like that.
I think you're right. I think that that's what most people expect. That's what I expected, mm-hmm. because the title is Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. And I was very, very pleasantly surprised with the way it's organized because I found that it's very thorough and it really does go step by step and explain things. Could you give our listeners an idea of the exhibit itself, the progression, where you start and how it's developed?
So we have four basic areas in the exhibition. The first one is an introduction, where we basically, in the first initial sketches of the exhibition, in the discussions between the curators, we actually thought of starting with Before Auschwitz and the story of Oświęcim, this small town in Poland, and we went back to the Middle Ages to explain that it has changed. It was right in the corner of different borders, so it kept changing from one country to another, depending on the historical context we were in. And then we went into the story of Judaism and what does it mean to be a Jew, actually, because we thought that if we go to the street in Madrid or in Sevilla or in Bilbao or elsewhere, and we ask probably a young person, what is actually a Jew? We were afraid of the answers. I think most of them were, it's just a religion, or some even would say it's race. So we thought people in Spain, I don't know, maybe in other countries this will be different, we don't really know what is actually being a Jew. And it's thanks to organizations such as Centro Sefarat and other organizations and the Jewish communities that they are trying to explain actually what does this mean to be a Jew. And that's why we wanted to have this room where we try to answer this question, because they will be, later on, they will be just be killed for no other reason than being a Jew. So it was very important to know what is it actually being a Jew. But going back, sorry, to the question, we have the introduction Before Auschwitz, where we explain gradually all the ingredients that made possible the extermination. Then we have, of course, the main section, which is Auschwitz. And then we have the last section, which is after Auschwitz. And we started with the introduction, actually, because we thought that it's a long way until we get to Auschwitz. It's not until room 10 that we actually begin to face Auschwitz. And we wanted to give a little bit of the camp experience, in the sense of facing the camp, to that average visitor, with the hope that we would catch their attention and then would be able to, okay, I've seen things they seem terrible, but you have not really explained why. I am interested. So in order to understand this, we need to go through the Before Auschwitz section.
Could you go through that with a little more detail? Because I think that the first nine rooms before getting to Auschwitz itself is what really impressed me most, because mm-hmm. I think most people have an idea of Auschwitz, have an idea of the mm-hmm. concentration camps and the Nazis and the horrors and all of that. But I don't think a lot of people know not only what it means to be Jewish in Spain especially, but the background, because you start out really with World War One.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is Robert Jan Van Pelt, one of the main, the chief historian and curator in the exhibition. He had done a lot of work in terms of trying to place Oswiecim as a city before being known as Auschwitz. And for us, it was very important, a few concepts. Of course, explaining the story of Oswiecim was something that had not been done. You can find books about it, but it has not been done in an exhibition. And then, of course, explaining what is the Jewish culture and what is actually being a Jew. And of course, if we speak about Jews, we have to speak about anti-Semitism. And I think it's very important, this notion. I hope people will understand a few these concepts, that it was not invented by Hitler. Unfortunately, it goes back probably until the beginnings of Christianity, and how this hatred against the Jew without any kind of rationality spread through our continent, and how much pain this has caused. And also, we then talk about anti-Semitism and then Jewish responses. And I hope people will see that there are different responses, and with this main concept of diversity. Because then Hitler or the Nazis will, or anti-Semites will just speak about the Jew, about one single closed group of people with one way of thinking, and it's actually it's one of the beauties of for me of Jewish culture is that it's so diverse and so different, and so it's very interesting to have the myth and then explain the truth. Then we go into the story of Germany and the First World War. We thought it was a very interesting connection to have the First World War, because it was the first gas attack, and of course the gas will become unfortunately very important in this story. And it's that moment where soldiers don't need to look into the eye of the other soldier to kill. It's this dehumanization of even the process of war. And then, of course, the situation of the Versailles Treaty, the economical crisis in the Weimar Republic and the hyperinflation. And then, of course, the political crisis and how politicians, in this case the Nazi Party, start to divide people. And I hope that people understand with this whole section that Auschwitz did not start with the gas chamber. And that is the final step in a very long process, but it's hatred, it's arrogance, it's dogma that created this possibility. We also have, I think it's terrifying, but it's to see this board game, Judenrausch, and this is done by a private company, because there is a demand, and this is what children play with, and it's the seat of hatred. And we have this terrible book that Germans' mothers read to their children when they were in bed, the poison mushroom. And we have many personal stories which help us to create an empathy. And then we start with the creation of the concentration camps and the ideology room. How easy it is to fall with being part of a group that protects you and that has one direction, and how warm you feel in and how difficult it is to be an individual and to stand out of the mass and stand with your foundations. I think it's very interesting. And of course, we then go to the invasion of Poland and the beginning of the Second World War, which will lead to the creation of a German concentration camp in Auschwitz.
And something else that's interesting is that you don't only talk about the Jews. You talk about the Roma, you talk about homosexuals.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we were sometimes sad is that when we went asking for help about creating an exhibition about Auschwitz, and some people or some organizations thought, well, it's a Jewish thing, and said, well, it is, of course, 90% of the victims were Jewish, and it has to be represented in that proportion in the exhibition, but it's about humans, it's about, you know, people doing terrible things to other people, and there are other victims of group victims. Of course, we have the Roma, we have the Polish, we have the Soviet prisoners of war, we have the Jehovah Witnesses, we have some homosexuals. So we try to keep a balance, and it's not easy, because I wish we could have had more information, for instance, about the Spanish Republicans that were sent to concentration camps. And unfortunately, the first sketches of exhibitions we had were 10 hours. And you have to, unfortunately, you have to cut, you have to edit, and you have to concentrate and try to focus in the basics. And by that, unfortunately, you do miss certain things. But we have a cultural program where we hope we can revisit these topics that unfortunately were not so present in the exhibit itself.
In the presentation of the exhibition on your webpage, you say that many of these artifacts are presented for the first time to the public after undertaking a painstaking process of conservation. What are some of these artifacts?
We have 600 artifacts in the exhibition. Most of them, 400, come directly from the archives of the collections of the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum. And most of these 400, I think it's about 95% actually, have never been displayed before, not even in the museum. So, of course, they had to go through a process of conservation that allowed the artifact to travel and to be displayed outside the museum. But it's not only the museum. I have to say that we have the loans from Yad Vashem in Israel, from the United Holocaust Museum, United States Holocaust Museum in Washington, the Wiener Library in London, the Jewish Museum in London, Sachsenhausen Memorial in Germany, the Seattle Holocaust and Genocide Center in the States, and of course private collections and relatives of survivors and victims who loan objects. So it's I think it's a unique collection that we tried, of course, to find artifacts that could help us explain each part of the narrative of the exhibition, and in that sense it was also very difficult, but I think we managed to do it.
When you first approached Auschwitz, mm-hmm. what was their reaction when you said you wanted to put this together?
I sent the first email to the museum probably the summer of 2009, and I got the initial answer was probably a few months later by email. And it was a nice answer, polite answer, but it was a no, which I understand, and which I think it was, things happen when they have to happen. But we never lost contact, and they were open to continue discussions, but it was clear that they at that moment, they did not see being able to happen. And I think their first reaction was probably of, I think I cannot speak on their behalf, so it's something we should ask them, but probably it was something that they didn't expect. So then we decided to, okay, we will keep in touch with the museum. We understand it's very difficult and it's not easy, but let's get a group of, because I am not an Auschwitz historian, I am not an Auschwitz expert. Now, of course, we know a bit or quite a few things about Auschwitz through all these years, but we work with historians and we work with experts and educators and the museum. And so we gathered this team with the curators and Van Pelt and Berenbaum and Talmot and Grieman, and we started to say, okay, could an exhibition be done even without artifacts about Auschwitz, without the museum? But the museum was always there, and when the team was put together, they started to be more interested, and I think it was also something very brave on their side. I have to say, it was a difficult decision for them to take part on this, I guess, and it was brave because it had never been done before, and they decided that the team and us, we were worth to trust and to work together, and so I have to say that there was a good relationship with the museum management, also because probably we were the same age, and that helped also a little bit. And they were slowly understanding our vision and our goal for the exhibition and how we wanted to do things and with whom. That's what I think, but I don't really know exactly which were their thoughts.
You mentioned a number of museums in different parts of the world that have helped contribute to this. Did you find any one particular organization that particularly was helpful or that stood out?
All of them. I have to say that we have been really lucky, and we speak about objects, but it was the same when it came to pictures, or images, or stories that we were looking for, Jehovah Witnesses, or homosexuals, or the Romans. Everybody, every institution that we approach, and we had the chance to go there and explain the project of the exhibition and the team, immediately it was everybody wanted to give their best. And I think that is something also very special in the exhibition. It's the plurality in the exhibit, not only of testimonies and voices from survivors, and but it's also of institutions. Everybody went in with giving their best, the best knowledge, the best images they had, the best artifacts in many cases. So it's amazing how people can get together when they believe a project can be useful for society. So I think all of them were really helpful.
Is there anything else you would like to add that we might have left out?
If we talk about institution, I have to also be very grateful to Centro Sefarad and the Jewish Community Association in Spain, because they were also very supportive from moment one. And you can ask Jessica and Esther and Fernando which were the first thoughts. That would be interesting, because they might be similar to what the museum might have thought years ago. But it was probably the same, they went for the same thing. I guess in first place it was like, do they know what they pretend to do? And then they were slowly understanding who we were and who we were working with and our vision and our intentions. And they were extremely helpful and supportive. And also other institutions in Spain, of course, Canal and the community. I mean, we brought a project which they could not see, and they had to trust. And it was not easy to say, you know, they could have done an exhibition about anything else in the world, and it would have been easier. And they decided that it was historically appropriate to have this exhibition, despite it's not easy. So I think they were very brave, the Canal Isabel II and the community of Madrid, to decide to say, yes, we are not going to do pickings this year or whatever other topic. We're gonna do Auschwitz because it's important to be done. So I think everybody that we have knocked on the door, they have been helpful. So that's what I can say.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you, so please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSefarad.com. See you next week.